This talk is going to be an overview about what's been going on in the lunar meteorite business. You old-timers or people who study lunar meteorites, you're not going to hear too much I haven't already said before. I hope there's people in the audience who don't know much about this topic. The lunar meteorites in our collections are the end products of a sequence of events, some of which are improbable. An asteroidal meteoroid strikes the moon and succeeds in accelerating a lunar rock to lunar escape velocity. That rock goes into orbit either around the Earth or the Sun. It eventually falls to Earth. Someone finds it, and someone recognizes it for what it is. We've learned that those first three steps are not all that improbable. Meteoroids hit the moon all the time, and apparently it's not so hard to kick a rock or accelerate it into lunar escape velocity. Once they leave the moon, sooner or later, they're going to fall into Earth's gravitational well. It's those last two steps that are the most improbable, the finding and the recognizing. The first rock, recognized to be a meteorite from the moon, was found in Antarctica by the ANSMET project, an NSF-sponsored program that has been searching Antarctica for meteorites annually since 1976. The meteorite was found in 1982, 9 years after the last Apollo mission. We knew it was a moon rock because we knew by then what moon rocks looked like. In detail, however, that first lunar meteorite, Allen Hills 81005, I'm unaware of any rock in the Apollo collection that's exactly like it. It has some properties that together it was a unique rock, but still clearly lunar. Moon rocks have been found in Antarctica by government-sponsored search teams from the United States and Japan ever since at a rate of about one per year. The first lunar meteorite stone from the Sahara turned up in 1997, and there have been about 44 more since then. The first one from Oman was in 2000, and there have been about 56 lunar meteorite stones in total from that country, which is the size of New Mexico. These hot desert meteorites are being found mainly by professional meteorite collectors and dealers, and in the Sahara by local people. Lunar and Martian meteorites sell for about $1,000 to $3,000 per gram, so there's a considerable financial incentive to go look for them. In fact, that's really what's driving this whole thing. All the lunar meteorites have been found in deserts in Antarctica. They are found in bare ice. In the hot deserts, they are usually found on carbonate desert pavements with little or no vegetation. They are found in such areas because experienced collectors know that surfaces where nothing much is happening are the best places to look for meteorites. You have to look at about 1,000 meteorites to find one from the Moon or Mars. 10 of the approximately 63 lunar meteorites are unbrecciated basalts from the lunar maria. In the absence of fusion crust, they look just like basalts. None have been vesicular, however. All the rest of the lunar meteorites are polymict impact breccias. Most are breccias composed of shock-compressed regolith, soil. Some are granulitic or impact melt breccias. This one I'd call a impact melt breccia, I'd guess. The clasts are unsorted with respect to size and only moderately rounded from abrasion. Aspect ratios of the clasts are seldom greater than 3 to 1, and there's no preferred orientation of the clasts. That's what happens when you make a sedimentary rock on a place where there's no water or wind and not much gravity. I'm telling you all this because I want you all to go out and look for these things. And then when you find one, call me first. There have been about 2,200 documented meteorites from Oman, and nearly all found in the last 9 years. More than half of these have been found in the Dhofar region, an area of about 8,000 square kilometers. About 4 kilograms of lunar meteorites have been found in this Dhofar region. Here's kind of a stylistic map. That works out to be a half a gram per square kilometer. One of these, Dhofar 25, has been lying out there for 500,000 years on the basis of cosmic ray nuclides. So if you use this number for time and multiply by the Earth's surface area, that's 440 grams, about a pound, of lunar rock falling on the Earth every year. Do you believe that? Yeah. All lunar meteorites have been... Oh, well, I'm sorry, I already said that, didn't I? Oop, oh, I'm not supposed to do that. Yeah. Yeah, let's see. Let's go. All right. Doot. Okay. From cosmic ray exposure data, we know that all the lunar meteorites we found were all launched in the last 20 million years, most in the last half million years. We know that it does not require a really big impact to launch one. An impact forming a one kilometer crater is big enough. I mean, that's a big crater if it happens in your backyard, but on the scale of the moon, that's nothing. I've heard no evidence suggesting that they come from some parts of the moon preferentially to others, so we assume that they're from random locations. That's a good thing, because we've got so many now, the lunar meteorites provide us with a type of global data that we did not have from the, did not get from the Apollo collection, a point I'll emphasize again later. Half of them, therefore, must come from the backside, the far side of the moon. Although people like to speculate, we don't actually know the source crater of any of the lunar meteorites. Some curious things are that no lunar meteorites have been found in the Western Hemisphere or Europe yet. None of them are observed falls. There are fewer Martian meteorites, and four of them have been observed falls. However, the Marsite falls tend to be, you know, kilogram-sized rocks, whereas a typical lunar meteorite is only a few hundred grams. Okay, I'm getting retrospective in my old age, and I've become intrigued by how my science has been influenced by coincidences and historical accidents. One such coincidence is that there's been the upswing in lunar meteorite numbers coincides just about at the time of lunar prospector gamma ray data. In the past several years, Clementine, Lunar Prospector, and the lunar meteorites together have given us a global view of the moon that we did not have while we were interpreting most of the Apollo data. The Clementine mission gave us many things, but one of the best was a map of the distribution of iron on the lunar surface. The blue areas are the low iron feldspathic highlands, and the red and white here are the high iron basaltic maria. Note that the highlands have about 5% FeO, whereas the maria are up in the 20% range. So here's a plot of aluminum versus FeO iron for the lunar meteorites, all the colored points, and just sort of for reference, all the stars represent soil samples from the Apollo missions. Again, the meteorites from the highlands have about 5% FeO. Those from the maria are up in the 20% region. The three major minerals in the lunar crust are plagioclase and iron, pyroxene and olivine, and in the maria, ilmenite is also important. Because of the simplicity of lunar mineralogy, lunar rocks necessarily plot along this fuzzy line between plagioclase and sort of the average of the iron-bearing minerals. There really isn't any mechanism for lunar rocks to plot off this trend too far. Most terrestrial rocks would fall in this triangle here because a lot of terrestrial rocks contain quartz and calcite that plot down here at the origin, effectively. Rocks and soils from the feldspathic highlands have high aluminum because there's 70 to 90% plagioclase. Some of the meteorites and many of the Apollo soils are mixtures of highlands material and maria material, so they plot in between. Most of the scatter in this plot represents a variation in the ratio of iron to magnesium. So here I've plotted magnesium to iron in the form of a bulk magnesium number. Within a group of rocks of similar lithologic type, the magnesium number tends to increase with increasing olivine to pyroxene ratio. For basalts, there's quite a range in magnesium number, and the meteorites extend the range actually over the range seen by the Apollo collection, and then there's this cumulate olivine gabbro that's unlike anything seen in the Apollo collection. There's also quite a range in bulk magnesium number among the meteorites from the highlands. This is perhaps one of the most important observations from the lunar meteorites. Nearly any general reference about the moon will say that the crust is composed of ferrone anorthosite because ferrone anorthosite was common at the Apollo 16 site. Unbrecciated ferrone anorthosites from the Apollo collection are typically 61 plus or minus plagioclase here, and they contain greater than 90% plagioclase. And the mafic minerals have an average magnesium number, I say, of around 61. The numerous feldspathic lunar meteorites tend to be both more mafic and a bit more magnesium on average than the unbrecciated anorthosites of the Apollo collection. These high Mg feldspathic breccias tell us that somewhere on the lunar surface there is a magnesium anorthosite crust. So far I've made this look simple. The complication involves the incompatible elements like thorium. Note that many of the meteorites are intermediate in composition between anorthosite and basalt, perfectly reasonable for mixtures of these two rock types, but several of them have higher thorium concentrations than any mixture. And remember, these are all, except for the red points, these are all polymic breccias. Such meteorites the ones in between probably come from Mare Highlands boundary areas or places where there's thin basalt flows on top of feldspathic highlands. Am I going the wrong way? Actually, it was no surprise that we've found meteorites with high concentrations of thorium. Here's a comparison between the meteorites in blue and where lots of little rocks from the Apollo collection, the little red points. Most non-Mare rocks in the Apollo collection are, in fact, richer in incompatible elements like thorium than any mixture of anorthosite and basalt and most of the meteorites. These thorium-rich rocks are mainly crystalline impact melt breccias and glassy breccias and regolith derived therefrom. These rocks were so unexpected and confusing when first found at Apollo 12 that they were given a very non-geologic name, creep. Nearly all of the creep impact melt breccias have crystallization ages of 3.9 billion years, and all of those rocks that we believe to be crystallized impact melt from basin-forming impacts are creepy impact melt breccias. There we go again. The model that developed from the Apollo samples went something like this. The end product of the magma ocean crystallization was ultramafic mantle and a plagioclase-rich crust, a flotation crust, and the final liquid of crystallization was trapped beneath this crust. This model was initially invoked to explain the observation that the breccias formed in basin-forming impacts were both more mafic than the crust and also considerably richer in incompatible elements. In this volume, the melt volume of big basin-forming impacts included mafic lower crust and perhaps some of this trapped liquid, the creep. What we learned from Lunar Prospector, however, is that the distribution of radioactive elements like potassium, thorium, and uranium, and by inference all of the geochemically incompatible elements, is highly asymmetric. From the view of the moon as a big round ball of chemical elements, this picture alone tells us that the moon differentiated asymmetrically by some mechanism, that the final liquid ended up mainly in one place near the surface on the near side. There is no indication here that creep was excavated by basins that happened over here. These observations led my colleague Brad Jolliffe to suggest that maybe it made more sense to think of the moon as consisting of terrains in the terrestrial geologic sense. There's this huge feldspathic highlands terrain on the far side and some on the near side. We've got this other terrain that we, let's call it the Procellarum creep terrain because we have to call it something. And perhaps the South Pole Aiken Basin should be regarded as another terrain because it's big, it's old, and clearly the crust developed differently there. Let's go to another slide here. Then about 3.9 billion years ago, in one of those cosmic coincidences that intrigues me, the last basin-forming impact to happen on the near side went splat right in the Procellarum creep terrain, spreading thorium-rich stuff all over the surface. Mare volcanism occurred later, partly filling the basin, covering a thorium-rich basalt, thorium-rich area with basalt. The great irony is that we did not know anything about the Procellarum creep terrain when the 40 years ago when the Apollo landing sites were selected. Nevertheless, three of them ended up, coincidentally, were right in the Procellarum creep terrain, and the other three were just outside on the Imbrium ejecta deposit. That's why many to most non-Mars samples from the Apollo collection are contaminated, we could say, with thorium and elements associated with creep. So going back to this plot, most of the highest thorium samples, impact melt breccias, come from Apollos 12 and 14, right in the heart of the hot spot. We don't have many meteorites of that composition because the meteorites come from all over the place. Similarly, we don't have many Apollo samples that are simple mixtures of feldspathic material and basalt because all such mixtures are usually contaminated to some degree with creep. The Apollo 16 mission was the only Apollo mission to land in the feldspathic highlands at a point distant from Mare basalt, so the samples have low FeO. And notice that that's about corresponds to about 2 or 3 ppm if I'd bothered to put the scale on. So on this plot, I'm just blowing up this next plot, this portion of the diagram. What you're supposed to see here, well, let's put it another way. For many years, we reasonably interpreted the Apollo collection as if it was representative of the Moon, and that the Apollo 16 site as it was representative of the highlands. But the Apollo 16 soil is considerably richer in thorium than all these feldspathic lunar meteorites, except one, because it contains these thorium-rich impact melt breccias. So the Apollo 16 site really isn't typical of the highlands, and it's only been in the last year that the first lunar meteorite similar to this Apollo 16 site's turned up. An interesting thing is that in the first go-around on processing the lunar prospector gamma ray data, the peak in the thorium distribution in the highlands occurred here at about 1.5 ppm. And those of us who were sample people, there were several of us who said, hey guys, there's something wrong here. We've got all these meteorites from the feldspathic highlands that plot down here at less than a half ppm. How come you're getting 1.5? And they kind of went back to the drawing board and figured that maybe they'd done their data reduction a little different, and that number came down. So in conclusion, there, I did it again. Oh, we can just leave that off. So in summary, I mean, the lunar meteorites complement the Apollo collection because the Apollo samples all originate from the central near side of the Moon, whereas the meteorites come from all over the place. We just don't know where. The distribution of lunar meteorite compositions is pretty much what we'd expect on the basis of random samples and the data we got from Lunar Prospector and Clementine. And in fact, the lunar meteorites have worked, as I just mentioned, is sort of a ground truth for calibrating the systems. One of the important things we've learned from the meteorites is that there are some areas of the feldspathic highlands that have higher magnesium to iron than we would expect based from the Apollo samples. And that's an important observation for models of lunar crust petrogenesis. And finally, some of the lunar meteorites are unlike any samples from the Apollo collection. In other ways, a couple of the basalts, for example, are younger than in the Apollo collection, expanding the age range to about 3 billion years. And we suspect that at least one lunar meteorite is from the South Pole Aiken Basin. These meteorites provide additional constraints for, again, for models of lunar petrogenesis. Okay, I'm done.
We have time for some questions.
I wonder about that. I mean, I don't understand why either. I mean, most of the lunar meteorites are not basalt. I mean, they're breccias. And boy, when you get those things into the lab and try to break them up into little pieces, some of them are really competent breccias. So you wonder why we just don't have a... I mean, there is one or two big ones. What's the biggest... biggest LAP?
The biggest one is Kalahari 009.
Oh, yeah, that's...
We
are clearly, they're here, we're just missing them. They look a lot like terrestrial rocks.
Any other further questions? Okay, one more.
We continue to worry about whether the Antarctic collection is biased. Certainly looking at that distribution in Oman suggests that there's got to be a strong bias from that area. How representative of the flux of lunar meteorites falling on the Earth do you think the rest of the collection is?
How representative of the lunar crust?
No, of the total amount of
balls. Well, I mean, the lunar meteorites virtually cover the entire composition range, if not expanded, that we've seen from the Apollo collection. So I like to think it's pretty representative.
Okay, our next speaker is my co-chair, Ryan Ziegler. Co-authors Bradley Jolliffe, Randy Korotev, Paul Carpenter, and a talk entitled Trace Element Analysis and Classification of Lunar Plagioclase and Olivine by Electron Microprobe Methods.